In a world that is rapidly changing, what should the roles of schools and public education be? What can we do to radically change our education system so that we prepare our students for the future? And what are some of the great schools doing to tackle these issues? Welcome to the Public Schools 360 podcast, hosted by Rana Arshad Hafiz.
Welcome back to another edition of Public Schools 360. I'm here today with Professor Dr. Jenny Wiener, an Associate Professor of Educational Leadership at the University of Connecticut. Her scholarship focuses on issues of educational leadership and organizational change, including the impact of gender and racial discrimination in educational leadership. She has presented at national and international conferences, with her work appearing in over 40 peer-reviewed journals, and is the author with Dr. Isabel Stevenson of the Strategy Playbook for Educational Leaders. She has also appeared as an expert on issues of women, leadership, and care work for a variety of events and media outlets, such as Good Morning America and NPR, as well as on a variety of podcasts. She holds an EdD and EdM from Harvard Graduate School of Education and currently lives with her partner, Jeremiah, their 10-year-old twin boys, Rufus and Manny, and their dog, Junior. Welcome, Professor Wiener.
Thank you so much for having me.
So to dig into this conversation, you are a parent, you're a professor of educational leadership. You think a lot about secondary schools. What do you think is the purpose of education in this day and time? And do our schools serve that purpose?
Thank you. I think that's a very fundamental question. One of the things we talk about in my classes, and I think I've talked about for a long time with colleagues and others in the field, is that there is a lack of general agreement regarding the answer to that, what seems like fairly fundamental question. And I think that a lot of the reason for the fragmentation that you see, or you know, sort of varying discourse about even reform efforts, has to do with a multitude of purposes and how people understand and think about that. I also think, you know, the idea about what the purpose is drives things that can drive policy initiatives that look quite different depending on the community, its values, and orientation towards the collective good. So with all that said, I would say personally, and what I would hope potentially would be the purpose of schools, would be to foster democratic ideals and liberation. So civic mindedness, sense of community, and orientation towards community building, truth, justice, the things that we, that many of us aspire to and hope for our young people. In terms of the degree to which I think that they're currently serving that purpose, I think it's really difficult to say. I think there are lots of pockets of places and very courageous educators and families and communities who are demanding their schools be beacons of liberation and justice, but it hasn't gone far enough. You know, there are also, I think, a growing number of voices for ideas like abolitionist teaching, culturally competent or sustaining pedagogies. All these things together, I think, support those ideas, reinstitution of civics, and an understanding of what it means to live in a democratic society. But you know, I think we're at a pivotal moment, and I think we're going to have to get right as a country about what we really want our schools to do and how we want to operationalize that. So I'm hopeful, nervous, but I do believe that schools can, and if we believed in it collectively, we could provide the resources to facilitate that kind of democratic ideal.
That's interesting because it, as you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, many times when we think about these things, the obvious questions that may come up in different groups is, what is liberation, what is democracy, who defines it, and, you know, which group are we talking about? Because these words, particularly in this day and time, seem to have different meanings for different people. So
I might push back on that a little bit. I mean, I don't know if those words have different meanings. I think that the underlying belief systems are not the same. So I actually think that there are clear definitions of things like democratic ideals, and they have to do with the idea that, you know, we are strong as together than we are as one, that sometimes we sacrifice, you know, one's sort of personal gain for the good of the community. We have a collective sense of care. But I think that we have different strands of philosophy and political philosophy in the United States, including what I would call sort of a libertarian kind of orientation, which is really not about democracy at all, but rather more about individual rights and privileges. So I hear what you're saying, that people use these words, but when you really push hard on their meaning to different groups, I think you get a quite different set of values and assumptions than you do if you talk to somebody else. So I don't think the actual words have different meanings. I think that people bring their political philosophies and then put them into sort of unnuanced descriptions that we don't often push back on, or we don't do our due diligence in really probing them to define their assumptions and beliefs, in a way to show that, in fact, that these are, in fact, different ways of understanding purpose. There are different ways of understanding the world and our responsibility to one another. Which, I mean, that may be what you're saying, but I just want to put a point on the idea that I actually think there are clear-cut definitions for these things, but for whatever reason, people want to make more opaque the truth about what they're fighting for or believe in, or because it's uncomfortable at the end of the day, if it's really pushed to say, in fact, what I'm fighting for is my own privilege and sustaining that over time. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to necessarily say that out loud, but I think when push comes to shove, if you ask the right kinds of questions and you probe the purpose, oftentimes that is what is underlying a particular orientation.
Yeah, are pushing ourselves to deeper thinking and to deeper recesses of what we believe and why we believe that is always a challenging proposition.
True.
You are a parent also, Jenny, and you wrote an article right at the beginning of the pandemic, which went viral in the New York Times. And that also, I think, alluded to what I'm going to ask you next. What are your hopes as a parent, and a parent who is so deeply embedded in secondary schools?
That's a really good question. And I think if you had asked me that question pre-COVID, I might answer differently than today. It's hard to sort of remember how I felt before all this happened. I think in terms of my hopes for schooling, formal schooling, it's really about opportunities to see and understand the world in ways that I potentially did not have the opportunity to, but also to open the world to my children, to foster curiosity, a sense of self and self-confidence, an orientation towards seeking truth, asking those questions that you just, you know, sort of articulated, right? The kind of reflexivity. And understanding, you know, my friend Carla Shalaby, who is incredible, you know, I was at a session with her and she said, you know, one thing it's important for people to understand is that you're special, but you're not more special than anybody else. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's something that I would love school to help bolster in my kids and their understanding of the world, you know, that there are no throwaway people, as Carla would say, and that we have a responsibility to each other and to seek multiple perspectives and understand each other in deep ways. And I mean, that's more than anything else, that's what I hope the public school in my neighborhood can do for my sons, and really just help them feel empowered to learn things and understand the world in a deep and meaningful way.
So many of the things you spoke about, Jenny, here are the social purposes of, you know, what as an infrastructural institution, what secondary schools do. And myself as a public school educator for more than 20 years, we know how unwieldy that can get. But with your experiences, can you speak about some ways schools are addressing these issues in however small ways, but they are deeply impactful on achieving this purpose?
Sure, sure. And I'll speak to this, you know, I'm speaking to this primarily as a parent, mm-hmm. Because my expertise is mostly around sort of schools as organizations, thinking about the professionals who work within them and their experiences. So I just want to be transparent about that as well. But I have a son who has an IEP, and often for, I'd say, anxiety, but also emotional dysregulation. And we have had two experiences in different school settings. And in the first setting, my child was made to be the problem, even though he was quite young. And most of the interventions, so I'm offering kind of a juxtaposition here. Most of the interventions were about isolating him, pulling him away from other children, taking away things like recess and other things that were the parts of the school that he liked, somehow to, I guess, make it clear to him that, you know, he needed to regulate himself despite the fact having an IEP. That would not be in keeping with what I'm talking about. In contrast, and in fact, even in the camp that he's going to now, when something happens, there's a dysregulated moment, or there's an altercation with another child or something, or an adult for that matter, they work hard to pause and repair. And, you know, I wouldn't necessarily call this full restorative practices, but I would be in that genre where the problem becomes a moment, a behavior, an issue that needs to be attended to amongst those who are involved. And they can work through that together when people feel ready. And then they move forward from that point. Now, that may seem small, but it completely, you know, reformed how my child felt about school himself. And I believe also sent clear messages about what that space does and is for. So to me, that would be an indication, right? Like, that's a place where the best, you are a multitude of things. And you are more than an instance or more than a particular behavior in a particular space. You're a whole person, and so are others, and they deserve dignity, as do you. And we can repair and move forward together to allow for full participation in the world and the world of learning. So to me, that's, you know, that's so huge. Again, having had a child on both sides of the spectrum, or, you know, in different kinds of contexts, where in one space I felt it was not oriented at all, and now we have the benefit of being in that kind of space. So that would be one small example.
So changing course slightly, though not completely, you are deeply embedded. You are a professor at the NEAG School of Education, which is deeply embedded in public schools, at least in the state of Connecticut. And you coach, you work with many, you know, principals, school leaders, and superintendents in Connecticut. And myself, as somebody who's in school leadership, I think about these things often, that there are certain aspirations I have about what schools should look like, can look like, and what I would like them to look like. But the bureaucracy of schools is so huge, and the school systems, particularly the way it is part of our social infrastructure. How do I move these systems, you know, to what my aspirations might be, or what any school leader who is thinking about this deeply, how would they think about this? Particularly when I think about this, what are the small steps? And you just wrote a book on this as well. What are the small steps that I can take, which are concrete, but which will lead me in that direction?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, first of all, I would like to say that I think that there are a multitude of like we could say equifinality, right? Like there are a multitude of strategies that I think and that people can deploy. And I think we need people across a spectrum. So what I'm going to offer is sort of what works for me or how I think about it. But that doesn't mean there aren't other strategies. For example, there are people who feel that, you know, large scale disruption is the only way to move the system forward. And that isn't my preferred model, but I think we need people like that doing that kind of work to facilitate everyone to push, right? We also have people who what you might call are tempered radicals. Judy Alston uses that term, as do others, and the idea that you work within bureaucratic systems and sort of push around the edges with a mission and purposefulness towards improvement, but you're not necessarily thinking about full reformation of the entire bureaucratic system. So I think, you know, again, I'm going to offer more sort of in between, but I would say that we need everybody working hard in the ways that they think can create the most and most positive change. In terms of your question specifically, I mean, I think one thing is it's quite hard to figure out what to do to get to a place you've never seen before. So I think just being open to the idea that everything could be on the table, right? So, you know, Chris Argyris talks about this idea of single loop and double loop learning. And one thing that I've noticed is that oftentimes when I talk to people about change, they focus on things within the margins. So they might say, you know, our discipline system is not working effectively, or we have a reading program that we don't like. We need to change the reading program. So they swap out one curriculum for another, for example. Mm-hmm. I would argue that that would be a sort of single loop learning, right? We're not really questioning necessarily why we teach reading this way, what we do, what kind of infrastructure do we have, you know, how does reading relate to other kinds of things that are happening in the school? Rather, we sort of say, okay, we understand the schema of reading, and so we're just going to swap one thing for another. Double loop learning, where I think the real power comes from in terms of really fundamentally reshaping and pushing on bureaucracies and systems for change, means asking questions about the why, right? Like, why do we even think we should be teaching reading now? Right? Why do we think that this kind of model of instruction works? Do we have the infrastructure and the human capital to make this run at the level that it needs to run? So that's my first comment. I think thinking about where could you engage in this kind of double loop learning where you ask the bigger fundamental questions, which can be overwhelming, fair enough, sometimes, but really are the only way to begin to say, I am not a prisoner by the bureaucratic system as it is currently, made. And put things on the table. Why are our class structure like this? Well, you know, is this benefiting kids? I think those kinds of questions are really, really important, even when you're operating at trying to do something more discrete or perceived to be more discrete because the school is a system. On that note, I think, you know, aspirations and always having big goals is really important. With that said, I think we often, I mean, there's an old saying, something like, you know, if you have 99 priorities, you have none. So I also think that if you are going to engage in double loop learning or deep change, then you really have to narrow your focus, because you can begin to imagine how one small, I'm using sort of air quotes now, one small change could actually facilitate the need to investigate everything within the context of your school. So then try to do that for 10 different things at once. And you notice, right, you're going to feel very overwhelmed very quickly. So, you know, one suggestion that I have is, well, first, equity at the center. But two, that it's really important to figure out what are, you know, one or two core issues that you're going to address, but you're going to address them at the level of sort of double loop learning versus sort of these technical changes. And then I think a third kind of item that I've noticed that people don't think about, but I think is really important for change, is we treat children in schools as learners, or I guess the best schools do. And we would never say, or we should never say, well, I taught it to them, you know, why didn't they learn it? But we do that to adults in schools all the time, right? We have one PD on a very complex new idea. We give it to teachers and then we criticize them for not immediately implementing whatever it was, which suggests that they also are not learners or do not have learning sort of systems that need to be attended to, supported, engaged with over time. And I think if we could treat adults with the same sort of humanity and orientation that they are in fact learners that require the same supports and help as children do, and culture, right? A culture of learning and mistake, you know, the being able to make mistakes without judgment or, you know, being penalized, then I think we could get much more momentum around improvement and change over time. Does that answer? I know those are kind of big ideas, but I'm wondering.
No, absolutely. I just want to dig a little bit deeper though. When you say, when you talk about priorities and choosing one or two priorities, and particularly alluding to the double loop learning, would you say that that big priority is a big idea, or is it a more concrete, tangible thing which leads to a bigger idea?
Could you articulate an example? I mean, I'm trying to understand the question.
So for example, hypothetically, let's say we put equity at the center of the work, right? If let's assume I'm a superintendent in the district and my number one priority or the only priority in the upcoming year is equity. Would it be helpful for me to think of equity in terms of, say, curriculum, you know, human resources, just spin it, because equity itself is a very
right. I understand. I understand. Yes. So I think equity touches every single component of schools. Like there is no space in which equity does not exist or shouldn't exist as a main driver of decision making. Mm-hmm. So I would call that sort of an underlying principle or value. I wouldn't necessarily name it as a goal. Like I think it needs to be, as to your point, I think it needs to be articulated within the context of something a little bit more concrete. So you might say, okay, I mean, you could, at the abstract level, you could say, you know, I want equity of, you know, opportunity and outcomes for all students. Okay, fair enough. But what would be the sort of mechanism? So you might say, I want to reform, you know, one of my students, Shannon Holder, studies tracking, okay, within schools. So you might say that your initiative, your sort of strategic plan involves detracking and ensuring that all teachers have access, all students have access to, you know, excellent teachers, right? That the teachers who have the greatest skill set and are the most skilled in what they do will be addressing the needs of the students to help them accelerate if needed. So I could imagine that being one of your goals, right? Like we're going to spend the year investigating sort of like what are the course taking patterns and opportunities for students within this district, if I was the superintendent. And then I would ensure that I would spend the year as a goal in ensuring that every student had access to the same rigor, quality, pathways of their peers. Right. But you can imagine that if you were going to really do that at scale, you have to look at enrollment, teacher placement, scheduling, special education, right? How special education placements are done, human capital resources around those issues, how teachers understand and think about children with differing needs. There's, of course, you know, implicit bias that would need to be attended to, because you might detract the classes, but there might be sort of soft tracking within a class based on teachers' belief systems regarding students' backgrounds, race or identity, ethnic identity, so gender identity, so on and so forth. So again, something that seems, I don't know if listeners would think of this as small, but you might say, we're going to do detracking. Well, that's actually quite complicated and complex and requires a full systematic response. So the idea that you would do detracking and another initiative feels to me quite overwhelming, and potentially would hurt the possibility that detracking could be fully actualized as well as something else.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes I feel detracking has become such a political issue, that what are we, can we do, can we just make every classroom super rigorous and give students choice and voice in the curriculum they have access to and not touch detracking as like a primary goal?
Well, I mean, I think that there's, well, I would say two things. This goes back to this purpose question, right? But I would also say there is nothing in schools that is not political. Mm-hmm. So this idea that any, this is just sort of how I mean, I feel this way, I think others might too, but you know, why I'm so adamant about equity being at the center is kind of the inverse of that. There is no such thing as a more neutral policy or action within a context of a school. Mm-hmm. There is just more adherence to the status quo, which is political. It's just political in the sense of that it's in whiteness and in the sort of majority culture. Or there is anti-racist action, there is, you know, sort of anti-patriarchal action, if that's even a word, and there's justice orientation. Mm-hmm. So I feel strongly that when people say, well, you know, this could be less political, to me that's sort of like, A, there's no such thing, but B, it's only less political for the comfort of those in power, mm-hmm. not for those who are experiencing it as marginalizing, problematic, lacking access to resources. So I don't know. I sort of think, you know, and again, this is a privilege of being a professor and not running a school myself, but I would say that one of my goals as a public intellectual is to really push people to say, I'm going to fight for values. And in fact, you know, if I get pushback, so be it, because the fight is worth it.
Absolutely. So. And sometimes, acquiescence to a political majority narrative decelerates or, you know, halts the rate or, you know, the rate of progress, which is really required to bring about the change as it should be brought. So that's a true danger of falling into that trap.
Yes. And I would also just say, I mean, this goes into my other research as well. You know, most teachers are white and are women. Most administrators are white, and proportionally more are white men. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to be transparent that in our society, those people have more privilege, right? So mm-hmm. I also think that it's important. I mean, it's important for white people and white men and school administrators who may feel when they push against things that they are marginalized in some way. I understand that. To also recognize the privilege that they have and that they need to not be complacent, but rather push against systems of oppression, because they have more ability to do so than some of their other colleagues who may suffer more repercussions for doing so, and or may not have the opportunity to leave because of discriminatory systems. So I would just, you know, put out a call and say, you know, understand that I think with privilege also comes responsibility, mm-hmm. to to deal with some of the potentially the pushback around these political issues, because it's the right thing to do. And we're lucky enough, you know, I'll speak for myself, I'm in a position of privilege to be able to use my voice in that way. And I would encourage others to do so, which does not suggest it isn't difficult or sometimes scary or nerve-wracking, but those aren't reasons not to do it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think of myself and, you know, I do feel that the most important work to be done in education, whatever role you might be in, is to be an activist, and, you know, in however you may define or see that role is, but constantly raise that voice, which may otherwise not be heard, and work around that.
100%, 100%. And, you know, it's a lot to put on people, and particularly mm-hmm. in this time, and I understand that, but I do feel like we're in a space right now, particularly around the discourses around educators and their priorities and who they are and what they value, that I think that we need more educators to use their voice, to put themselves in the public sphere, to fight against and tell the truth about what this work looks like. And that's a way to kind of use your voice and also disrupt, I think, you know, toxic narratives about school and schooling and teachers and that really need disruption. So mm-hmm. I encourage everybody to use their voice and to see themselves as public actors and purposeful and driven in that space. You know, it's a great privilege to be a teacher or to be an educator. I feel that way.
Absolutely.
And that we, you know, that we need to make sure that we're part of, if not controlling the narrative about what's happening in schools and what we need and what we deserve. So mm-hmm.
There's a lot of conversations happening. And certainly as a school leader, I think about that a lot, that school, this has been the whole COVID experience, the pandemic experience is a time for us to reimagine what schools are going to look like after the pandemic. It has, you know, there were voices asking for change before this experience, but now the technology and the opportunities have just made, you know, this is the perfect time to do it. So when you think about what schools can look like after this experience, what are some thoughts in your, what are you thinking?
Mm. I mean, I think, you know, the jury's still out. So I'd hate to move too quickly in terms of what worked and what didn't, because I think there was a lot of variability. I do get kind of itchy around some of these conversations about innovation, because to me, sometimes I think innovation is used as kind of a word to suggest newness. Mm-hmm. Right? Like so going back to kind of like the single and double loop, right? Like that innovation just means doing something new. And I think that that's, we already had that problem, right? Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. I think actually true innovation and, you know, I'm sure somebody's going to take issue with this, but would be to actually ask deep questions to think differently about what we do and why we do it. Right. So for me, I would love to see, and I think an opportunity, for example, so I was working with my colleague Chantal Francois around this question of like, okay, we've had the discourse for a really long time that schools, and particularly, you know, schools serving primarily, you know, BIPOC students or in urban areas, require high levels of accountability to function effectively. I guess, you know, the assumption being that if we don't watch these people carefully, they're not going to do what they're supposed to, a premise I find somewhat offensive. But regardless, you know, under COVID, external accountability systems disappeared. Mm-hmm. Right. So if that assumption was correct, then we would therefore think that without these sort of external pressures, school teachers wouldn't show up, they wouldn't do stuff for kids, they wouldn't work hard. And in fact, in my research, we've seen quite the opposite, right? That actually, you know, schools in hard hit areas or places where students, let's say, are under-resourced or may need the school as a place for food and healthcare and other things, like went above and beyond, you know, sacrificing their own health and well-being, teachers and administrators, to ensure that their students had what they needed and made it a learning space. And so that is all to say, like, wouldn't it be innovative to me would be to question what kind of accountability systems actually function to support learning for adults and students within schools, mm-hmm. right? That would be an innovation. And it would challenge a discourse that actually had very little evidence of improving, supporting schools or professionalizing teachers or, you know, moving kids forward. So, you know, I think, you know, innovation to me would be the understanding that actually what's needed are resources, fundamentally investing in human capital, teachers' capacity to serve, and potentially putting back on the table, not just bringing new ideas in, but asking what were the things that we were doing that need to go, right? Mm-hmm. What are the things that need to stay? And those are the kinds of conversations that at least I would like to see and I'm trying to push for, which is a bit different, I think, than how I often hear the conversation, which is like, what are the new things should we keep?
Right. No, I would like to... Personally, if I had an ideal school, it would look very different and feel very different from many of the schools that I serve in. But at the same time, I use the word innovation with great trepidation, exactly for the reasons that you've said. You know, innovation seems to mean that every kid should have a Chromebook, or, you know, every teacher should have a Nearpod, and, you know, we should flip classrooms. But we do not address the deeper issues of education and how do we support and promote deep thinking in our adult and, you know, young learners in a school system equally, because, you know, the whole system will move only if both of them are learning at a similar rate, or, you know, there is true commitment for learning of both those groups of people.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think you said it beautifully. And I just, again, you know, this goes back to your question about sort of how do we make change? You know, I think this is really underattended to, but everything that we know about research or your own, I think most people, if they're listening, like their own lived experience, like what were the attributes of the organization or the community when you felt the most open and available to learn, right? Mm-hmm. To grow, to change? Were there places where somebody was standing over your shoulder and beating you down and threatening you that we're going to close this if you don't make your numbers? Were there places where you were ranked and you know, filed every day? Probably mm-hmm. not, right? There were mm-hmm. places where you felt encouraged, supported, you had the resources you needed, the outcomes were clear. You felt that that people were rooting for you. And I think that those, we need more of that. But we're so hesitant, I think, sometimes to really, and potentially we're not given the time or space to do so, but to say like, what wasn't working and how innovative it, would it be to say, wow, you know, like fundamentally, why wasn't this working? Or let's examine the assumptions belying this particular way of doing things, and coming up with a solution that exists outside the box of the bureaucracy or outside the box of how we've fundamentally thought about these things over time, mm-hmm. Which is really, really hard to do. It's not easy. So
Yeah, and I'm sorry to interrupt. No, I was going to say that even more than the bureaucracy, I feel that the second part that you said, we are limited by our own thoughts. You know, bureaucracy limits us just as much as we imagine it to be. You know, it does give us wiggle room, which we don't take for ourselves.
Great point.
Yeah. So moving on to another word, which again, every other district, particularly districts which have a large homogeneous population of students, seem to be doing this now, is having a diversity and equity and inclusion and social justice initiative in their district. Many districts are using their ESSA funds to do that. And I feel like I've done this work all my life, right, from my childhood. And I don't understand what would that work look like in this day and time, like even as something that is so central to who I am as an educator, as a person, and for me, those two identities very much overlay each other. And I think about that, you know, what does this equity work look like? So if you could talk a little bit about that, that would be, what are your thoughts on this?
Sure. I mean, I'm going to talk about some of the research that I have done around people who are experts in this rather than myself. But just to kind of put a name to some of the things I think you're saying. So Terry Watson speaks to this idea of performative wokeness, which is this idea that we sort of put on the airs of we white people, but others, you know, others could engage in it as well, of wokeness, right? We wear a Black Lives Matter t-shirt, we read White Fragility, and we speak to and use the language of equity, and maybe even police others around sort of that language. But when push comes to shove around privilege, there isn't a lot of movement, right? So I think that's really important to think about this question of when you are engaging in equity work, what should that look like? And is it just about sort of intrapersonal work? And I would suggest that may be one part of it, but system change is really what we're going for. So in thinking about that, just to keep going, when I was young, I'm a child of the 80s, color blindness was sort of the orientation. Not sort of, it was, which was the idea that, of course, that you don't see color. And if we could just, everybody could just accept one another, there would be enough to go around, right? Sort of alongside this idea of color blindness was also this idea that we could increase equity or equality for everyone, and all that meant was that everyone would get more, right? Mm-hmm. As I've gotten older, I think, I've learned a lot of things and I'm still learning, but one idea that I think is really important is the idea that, in fact, there are some people currently who get too much, right? That this idea that increasing equity means everybody gets more is a falsehood, right? Because what we really need is the idea that, in fact, some people have been at the table or have had the whole pie, or they've had a larger slice of pie. We don't need to start breaking up minuscule pieces of the pie, right? We need a new pie. But that involves people who have privilege and power understanding that they got that on the backs of someone else, literally and figuratively, and to maybe give some of that up, which of course is incredibly difficult to convince people that that's a good path forward. But the more I'm around, the more I understand that ideas like, you know, myth of meritocracy, this idea that you know, if people have more, they've earned it, helps to foster these ideas of color blindness and sort of a falsehood around how equity operates. So that is all to say that I think when you really do equity work, you have to look at who has the resources, power, and privilege within an organization. Like, where are resources being directed? Where are budgetary resources being directed? In a school, in a district? Where is human capital being directed? And really investigating about who is that human capital resources, financial and otherwise, serving? And be transparent about that. And when you see disproportionality or, you know, more resources going to sort of a group that already has opportunity, then I think it's time to really start thinking structurally about why that's the case and how could we reform it. So tracking seems to be one of them. I think budgets could be huge, right? There's these questions about mm-hmm. equity audits and where are resources being sent as an opening salvo to really do equity work, which is different than having everybody do a book club about a book that makes them, you know, think deeply about themselves. So I think that would be, again, I know that's a bit sort of broad in scope, but to me, I think a direction, sort of directing our attention, not just on intra or interpersonal, which are important, but fundamental sort of systems work that mm-hmm. requires questions about power, privilege, and resources distribution, and for whom, to what end, why, and how.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot about resource appropriation. I don't know if you had an opportunity to listen to that podcast last year, Nice White Parents.
Yes, I did. My goodness.
Yeah. So, and I have thought about that in my work all the time, that, you know, how do I invite parents who may otherwise not feel invited, or just don't have the time to be on the table? You know, I live in Stamford, Connecticut, and I do a lot of community work here. And somebody from Stamford Public Schools came to me and said that, you know, in the school surveys, and it's great because this is because of the kind of relationships the Muslim community, the Southeast Asian community in this area has with the school system. They came back to us and they said that a lot of the VC that, you know, the particularly we have a very large Bangladeshi immigrant population, that they don't fill out the community surveys ever. And we don't know how to engage them. I felt this was a great opportunity for us to get engaged with that kind of work, but then also the challenge of the work, because you know how much the community doesn't even want to get engaged in that work, just because I feel that they have felt left out, or they're so busy with so many other things that, you know, this is not something that's important to them at this point of time. So how do we engage a community in work like that? So
that's interesting. I wonder. I mean, I don't know the community. So I don't want to speak out of turn, but I might just offer that I might think about it also about why does the school define the parameters of what engagement is and how we mm-hmm. understand it, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I think, you know, I think that there, one of the things about equity also, or let's say, liberation or justice, is to not impose my understanding of engagement, which comes through my lens and my understanding of the world, on other people, right? So a form of engagement might be, and again, I don't know this population, so I don't want to overstate, but I'll speak to like similar narratives that I've heard around other families and groups with whom I work, would be, well, they don't show up. Well, to me, engagement means that I work three jobs to facilitate, you know, my child living in a particular zip code and paying rent that is expensive for me because I believe the school to be the right school for my child, or that I've heard that this school is of high quality. And so I'm working as hard as I possibly can and engaging in that way. To facilitate, you know, insurance that my child has access to things. I think, you know, one of the narratives around COVID, which I think was really important relative to engagement in families also, like this is a counter narrative that I think is important, is, you know, the idea that if you're at home, you lose learning. How can you lose learning that never existed? And that as if family life, whatever that looks like, or if it doesn't look like sort of middle class white mm-hmm. family life, that you don't learn from that, right?
Absolutely.
That doesn't have so I hear what you're saying, and I'm not suggesting that people and groups may not feel that the school has made it impossible for them or difficult or uninviting, and they may give up. But I might just offer that this could be an opportunity for innovation in rethinking the entire kind of orientation about what parent engagement or community engagement or caretaker engagement looks like. And perhaps it's on schools also to redefine those parameters to facilitate more inclusivity. I think that's all I'm offering.
No, absolutely.
Again, not knowing that community specifically.
No, I could not agree with you more, Professor Wiener. And like, you know, in my own household, we just have one child. And my husband was never, you know, engaged with the school by the school's definition of engagement. And I would often offer that as an example, but our son is the most important thing in his life, right? But he did not think that kind of engagement was the most important engagement with whatever time he had to be present in our son's life. So, you know, there we do impose our own understanding of what engagement means. What does it mean to be a parent who's involved with a child? What does that look like? So, absolutely. I do feel there is, you know, for many people, surveys are not important. Like, you know, they feel they don't get you anywhere. They don't find meaning in that kind of stuff. So,
right. But you might also wonder sort of like, I mean, one of the things that came out in a lot of my interviews of principals during COVID was, you know, people may have, you know, for example, is it phone compatible? Is the survey easy to do on a phone?
Mm-hmm.
Is it fully translated? You know, if it's contingent, many of the schools spent all this time and money giving every child a tablet, never thinking about access to internet, mm-hmm. you know, or the fact that like there are going to be three kids in a home who all had to be on the internet at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think sometimes in an effort to be inclusive, it's still done through a perspective of privilege. And so rather than sort of finding out from people like, you know, instead of doing a survey, what if people went to the mosque and mm-hmm. talked to the parents, right?
Mm-hmm.
Could they access it? So I think sometimes, again, in an effort to try to solicit information or to provide resources, it's still being done by policymakers, big P, little P, who have a different lived experience. And so they're not necessarily, and not as a failing, but just as a truth, mm-hmm. not necessarily considering what those features might be that are keeping people from accessing or engaging with a resource that you're trying to provide. So mm-hmm. I think that that's really important too. But I think what you said about your husband is quite powerful. So I appreciate you sharing that.
Thank you so much. So this brings us to, you are a professor of educational leadership. And at the onset of this conversation, you mentioned about how we see more men in leadership and a larger percentage of men who enter education, secondary education, they rise to become leaders, and whether school leaders or district-wide leaders, compared to women. What do you think is the role of diversity in leadership in driving the change for our schools? Like, I have personally felt in my own lived experience and the way I see schools, the lack of diversity has had a great impact on this. And when I say the word diversity, I really mean it from a multi-pronged perspective. People who think differently, who look different, who feel different, because we don't have those thought partners on our table as we think about many little P policies and the big P policies.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I completely agree with you. I mean, I think, you know, we're limited, everybody's limited. And that, again, that's not a criticism, it's just a fact. By their own lived experiences. And we have an increasingly, you know, diverse student population, whether that be sort of ethnic, racial, religious, you know, language speaking, so on and so forth. And we haven't seen that same, you know, that same kind of multitudes in our teaching staff, administration, so on and so forth. That isn't to suggest that white people can't be wonderful teachers of, you know, students from other backgrounds, but it does, you know, again, we're all limited by our experiences. And so to not have voices in the P, small, big P policy range that are coming from those spaces or role models or you know, people who have those same experiences and can speak to that, I think is a huge deficit and a real problem for our systems. It also, you know, I think another question to ask is, you know, why is this the case, right? Mm-hmm. So what I mean by that is, what is the way in which leadership is constructed within schools and school systems, whether at the teacher leader level or even, you know, how is teaching constructed, that makes it so that only certain kinds of people have access, right? Or are repeatedly selected for these positions. So to me, that's an important piece of investigation too. So why is it, right, that over the years, despite, you know, somewhere around 85% or 86% of teachers being women, we're looking at only about, I think, 53% of principals being women, 30% of the high school level, and only 26% of superintendents being women. And then, of course, you know, if we looked at women of color or, you know, people of color generally, those numbers are even smaller. And to me, that's a question about, okay, well, what do we think leadership is? And I think for whatever reason, well, there are reasons, but it's not worth getting into right now. You know, it's really been constructed, at least in the education sphere, as sort of this heroic, strong leader who's going to come in and, you know, solve the problems of a school. And, you know, we can think about adjectives that go around that, you know, sort of like strong or innovative or, you know, passionate. I think those qualities themselves are not bad, but a lot of that ideas about this heroic leader actually are not the ones that align with our previous conversation around creating spaces for everyone to learn, grow, make mistakes, you know, be effective in their role. So there's this weird bifurcation between this, how we have manifest our hiring practices and who we think can be a good leader in schools and the literature and research, and even some of the kind of discourse around things like shared leadership or distributed leadership or trust or, you know, professional learning communities. So I think that that's worth thinking about too, right? Like, it's, yes, it's about diversity in terms of sort of just we need a more reflective group of people, meaning reflecting those whom we serve, so we're ensuring to address the issues that they bring to the table. But we also may need to do some work around how are we constructing leadership in the space, and is it in fact aligned with the goals of having high functioning organizations where people can grow, learn, and address the kind of changes that you brought forth earlier in our conversation. And I would say no, but those things are intertwined, right? Like over-reliance on white men to lead us and the fact that we also have been oriented towards sort of top-down bureaucratic accountability and inspection as a means of improving schools, which of course there's no evidence to suggest that in fact that would happen.
Thank you so much, Professor Weiner. This was such a lovely conversation. But before we go, if you were to imagine a school, an ideal school where your sons are able to go, where we serve all the children, you're three or four, what does it feel like? What does it sound like?
Wow. Well, I have to say, I'm very happy with the school that my children go to now. My son is in a special program. So I have twins. One is in a special program. One is in a mainstream classroom environment. But I mean, some of the things that I notice, how the adults speak to, and you know, obviously there's some variability, but how the adults speak to the children, that the children's ideas and thoughts and views are honored and appreciated. And there are people every morning greeting my children and expressing a kind of love for them and a care for them. A place where, you know, people treat each other with dignity. And there is, when you walk into a classroom, you see and hear diversity of thought and experience, and those are elevated, and that there's ideas about, as I said earlier, equifinality, right? Like there are different ways to achieve the same goal, and those are appreciated. Experimentation, a civic orientation. So I think those are some of the things, and to be honest, joy, like, you know, kids laughing and noise and mess and muck and all that kind of stuff. So those are the things I would like to see in forgiveness and restoration and respect. So, you know, it's hard for me. I am getting a little emotional even saying it, because sometimes it's hard to imagine that, but I don't know. I still believe, I always say, like, to be in this business, you have to be a little bit Pollyanna-ish or naive, right? Like at the core, in my fundamental core, I'm optimistic and believe the best in humanity, and believe that we can get there if we can center love and humanity first, which is, you know, hard. It's hard when we're all worn out and we're all tired and we all are human. But that's what I hope for. That's what I would like to see.
Thank you so much, Professor Wiener. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.